Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Hi, everybody. We are really excited tonight to have André Dubus with us. And I'm told, without giving it away, I'm told that this may become something. And evidently, Pee Wee Herman is going to be cast as him. Now, if you believe that, you'll believe anything. So let's just welcome him and get on with a wonderful evening. And then we can cast the movie. Okay. Here.
Oh, Pat. She said, so who's going to play you in the movie? I said, Pee Wee Herman. Can you guys hear me? Is this on? Yeah, I don't need this, do you? So I'm going to read you the entire book. It'll take 14 hours. No, you know, I mean, what I love about these things, and thank you for coming, by the way. I love that Q&A conversation. So I'm not going to talk and read at you for too long. I think I will read like 12 and a half minutes from it. And I don't know. Let's talk about whatever you want. Life, writing, publishing. I know a lot of writers come to readings. Let me say this, though. I had no intention of writing a memoir. You know, I tend to be a fiction writer, I think. Well, let me pull that back. I think most of us, if we write, we're just writers. You know, when I think about it, my wife's a dancer. She's also a painter and a choreographer and a sculptor. She's also a pretty good screenwriter and, you know, she upholsters furniture. She can't cook worth a damn, but that's okay. I cook. But she's the clothes lady. She just got really mad. I'm the cook. I buy all the food. I cook all the food. But she does all the clothes. I don't know. We have a joke. If the aliens abducted me, the kids would starve. If the alien abducted her, the kids would be naked. So I think I like writing fiction more than any other kind is what I'm trying to say. I've written all kinds of stuff. But let me tell you how I came to write this accidental, semi-reluctant memoir. I was, you know, the thing that I like most and I think love most about writing is that it's really more of an act of discovery and an act of exploration than it is an act of exposition. I think it's less that the writer knows a bunch of things and then shows it off to you. That's actually what exposition means. Expositional writing is you're showing the reader what you know. And that can be good if you've taken a history class and you've memorized the dates, and I think that's where that comes from. But I think most writing is a free fall into the psyche, and I think most writers, at least most writers I know, tend to work without a map, and they tend to go from one true word to the next and see where it goes. I was been talking about Faulkner Day at the Lighthouse, and then I did this talk at the Women's Press Club, but I have to quote him again. He was asked late in his life, you know, what's the main thing that the writer needs, Mr. Faulkner, in order to have a chance at creating what you have, sir? And he said, well, it ain't talent. He said, I used to think it was talent, but I don't anymore. And what do you think he said it was? He narrowed it down to one quality of mind. What do you think he said? One thing the writer needs. Did you just say that? I know you, don't I? You look familiar. What did you say, though? Nailed it. What's your name?
Kate.
And the class is dismissed. Good night.
Yeah, that's it.
Curiosity. And his exact words were curiosity, insight, to wonder, to mull, and to muse why man does what he does. And if you have that, then talent makes no difference whether you've got it or not. You know, I do think that people have this notion that that writers know things. That and I think even if people don't think they have that notion, I think it's almost a semi-conscious notion that writers know things, that they've written books because they have an insight into something we don't, and so they have to just spew it forth. Well, I think about Ken Burns, the filmmaker. Ken Burns, a filmmaker. You know who Ken Burns was, right? American Treasure. What put him on the map was that 11-part gorgeous work of art about the Civil War. And back in the late 80s, early 90s, right? And I remember I just stumbled across the first 5 minutes of the first episode on PBS in north of Boston, where we live. And then I was glued. I watched all 11 episodes, all 36 hours, whatever. And it's an absolute masterpiece. And I think you must – I don't think it's possible to know American history without having seen that memoir – I mean, documentary. So Burns was asked by a reporter, "Mr. Burns, did you get your doctorate in American history, sir?" No, never went to grad school." "Oh, well, then you must have gotten your BA in U.S. history. Is that right?" "No, English." And you can start to feel the panic settle in with the journalist. "Well, then you certainly, you must be a history buff, right? You've read all these books in the Civil War and you're just bursting with information. You had to share it." "No." And now you can hear outright panic. "Well, Mr. Burns, what exactly inspired you to make this film?" "So, well, I was at a dinner party and the Civil War came up as a subject. And I was sitting there sipping my wine, and I was kind of asking myself, when the hell was the Civil War anyway? It was the late 1800s, I know that. Was that the 12-year war? No, that wasn't 12. 10, was it 10? I know Lincoln was involved. It had to do with slavery. Pretty sure the North was for it and the South, or vice versa. And he said to the journalist, "Honestly, I realized I knew nothing about the American Civil War, so I made a movie about it." Isn't that beautiful? All right, so here's an image from my own life. To support my writing habit over the years, especially throughout my 30s, exclusively through my 30s, I was a self-employed carpenter. And I was also an adjunct writing instructor at like 5 universities in the Boston area. You know, the migrant farm workers of academia. You know what I'm saying? No benefits. You get paid by the course. When you think about it, you're probably paid 43 cents an hour. And I made so much more in the carpentry days than the teaching days, but it was nice when you're up on a roof in February. Tomorrow I'm in a classroom. And so my third novel takes off, and it gets Oprah-fied, and I've got money for the first time, and I get to build my own house. And I was 40-something years old and had only lived in rented houses and apartments. My family had never owned a house. I'd never owned a house. Going back generations, we were rice farmers and mule skinners and no money anywhere. And no landholding. I mean, we were just vagabonds. And so I was kind of breaking a long family line by building a house in the woods. And my younger brother, Jeb, is the genius in the family. Seriously, he taught himself to play classical guitar when he was 13 years old. Classical guitar. Just by listening to Andrea Segovia records on his record player. Listening. He designed my house, and because he's not an architect, you know, with all the plumbing chases, electrical chases, all the live load, dead load stuff, I took it to a structural engineer, had to give him $17,000 to put their stamp on it. They didn't change one thing. When we were kids, my brother used to get, for birthdays, guitar strings, art supplies. I'd get underwear, a sweater. And I say this to you for a serious reason, because I and my two sisters at the time, we deduced Jeb's special, he has an imagination, we're normal, we don't have one. And you know, I think that's a crime. You know, I did a talk, one of these cool things where the whole town reads your book and they, you know, that's a beautiful thing. And this was Walnut Creek, California. It was before Oprah picked my novel, House, Sand, and Fog. And I couldn't get over what a beautiful thing this was. It's a writer's wet dream. They all read your book. They put you in a theater, 5,000 people sit there. And then you sign books and you sign books and they fly you home and they put you up and think. And on the way home, I mean, it's a fantasy I couldn't even have imagined when I started writing years earlier. And I had a strange bad taste in my mouth about the experience. And I think, what is wrong with you? My dad, God rest his soul, had a beautiful expression. You go to him, you say, "Dad, our VCR broke. We can't rent a movie tonight." Or, "Dad, I never said this to him. I'll give you a better example. I'm not reading from the book. I'm just going to talk. I was at White Plains at a cousin's wedding, and this beautiful woman in her 50s, all dolled up, comes into the foyer. I'm with my little boy at the time. He was little at the time. He's not little now. And she's screaming, "Oh, my God! Oh, my God!" And she's got a hat box from Lord & Taylor. I'm thinking there's like a human head in there or something. Gwyneth Paltrow. You know, it's a movie reference. And I'm about to shield my son's eyes, and she opens the box. And she says, "They sold me two right boots! Two right boots!" And I said to my 5-year-old son, Austin, I said, "You know, that's what your grandfather would call a first world problem." So much of what I'm talking about, these are first world problems. So where the hell was I? I was talking about my brother. Oh, and I realized why I had the bad taste in my mouth, leaving this one city, one book, beautiful experience. Because there was this subliminal sort of energy in the room that we lowly readers, we bow down to imaginative writers who write these books we get to read. And while I had loved the attention, it didn't square with my experience of people. It didn't square with my experience of having been a kid around other kids. It certainly didn't square with my experience once I had 3 kids with my wife, and then all the kids you get when you have kids. Every kid gets an imagination. I truly believe everybody gets one. And now I've been teaching writing for years. I've probably taught over 7,000 people. I don't think anyone's is any better than anybody else's. That's not to suggest that more interesting stuff doesn't come from some people than others, because more interesting stuff does come from some people. But my own opinion, I don't think that's the fault of their God-given imagination or their God's-given or their universe-given imagination. I think it's the problem lies with the tools they're using to get into it and to get out of it. So I believe in the imagination. I believe everybody's got one. And I believe that what fuels it is what we don't know, not what we know. And I've always believed in the, not always, but I've learned to have faith in the power of the sliver of an image from your life. I bet you I could, let me just ask you, how many of you have images or slivers of images from your life that are floating there? You don't really know why they're there. They're images like this, the way the light looked on your mother's face on a rainy day when you were 6 on the couch. You know, a bicycle in the rain, or you know, the car pulling away when you were 12 of your Uncle Joe, who you hardly know. How many of you have these floating around? I bet we all do, right? And my experience has taught me that the ones that linger tend to have imaginal roots. And if you open them with words or paint or, you know, music or dance, I think words are the most precise tool. I'm not saying that because I'm a writer. I think because they're man-made inventions of the psyche. They penetrate the psyche much deeper. The word potato will penetrate your psyche much deeper than the color yellow. It just will. And so I've learned to trust these images. So here's an image from my life. My brother and I are building my house. He designed it. We're building it. It took 3 years. It was a beautiful ordeal. I'm still building it, frankly. We don't have a master bathroom, okay? So we have 3 teenagers and 1 shower. I tell my wife, "Honey, that's the first world problem." She wants the friggin' bathroom. And one day I hire some young guys to do labor on the house, hauling stuff while we're doing the skilled carpentry stuff, and we're having coffee. And at coffee break, the young guys are talking baseball. And my brother, who's 41 years old, says to me at the time, I was 42, "So, what, there's an American League and a National League?" I said, "Yeah, what's that about?" He says, "I don't know." I said, I really don't know either." And we didn't. So somehow 2 guys north of Boston, Red Sox, in the 70s, Red Sox Nation, Celtics, Patriots, Bruins, we didn't get on any of those trains. To this day, my 51-year-old brother, he couldn't tell you that he doesn't even know the Patriots in the Super Bowl. He sure doesn't know the New York Giants took our crown. All right, so as you parents know, whatever your kids get into, you get into, right? So my kids got into baseball. We have an older son, daughter, son. When my older son was little, he got enamored of it, saw it, wanted it. So, you know, he's playing T-ball, C-ball with the coach pitching. And then around B-ball, when around 8 or 9, when the other kids are pitching to the kids, I noticed it was getting much more competitive with the parents and the coaches. And I heard a coach say once to a kid, it was a playoff game, and my son was the pitcher, one of the pitchers. The opposing coach said to the kid, Tommy, I don't want nothing but strikes, kid. Nothing but strikes. Thinking, holy shit, Pedro Martinez doesn't throw nothing but strikes. That's it, I'm coaching. So I started to coach to protect my son from this drill instructor energy as a 47-pound athlete. Except I didn't know how to play baseball. Because I'd never played it, never watched it. So I'm a coach who doesn't know how to play ball, who's coaching. I thought I was going to write a funny essay. 550 pages later, I realized that I wrote what I was doing instead of playing baseball. We write what we don't know we know, Grace Paley said. I knew the facts of my story, but I had to go back to it. If you look at the word to remember, the opposite is dismember. Chop, chop, chop. Remember means to put back together again. I'm convinced that's why we go to therapy. We know daddy was an alcoholic and mom had three boyfriends in the house. We know what happened, but what the hell happened? And we have to go back. And what do? They have you lie down. So I've read. They have you lie down. They ask you questions. I've been in therapy. I recommend it. And what do? They coax out your story. You know it, but you don't. But you do, but you don't, but you do. So I'm just going to read a short section. What we were doing instead of playing ball was our parents got divorced. It was the late 60s. My dad, who became the beautiful short story writer Andre Dubuis, was an obscure junior college teacher making $7,000 a year. That was a lot more in the late 60s, early 70s than now, but it still wasn't much for four kids and wife and a rented house, blah, blah, blah. So now they break up, and his $7,000 has to pay for his new used car, his new apartment, us four kids, his ex-wife, our rented house, and we went from poor to poorer. As so often happens in marriages, you know how this happens? I find it very sad. I see it with marriages around me. Husband or wife leaves, and the friends peel off and stay loyal to one and dump the other. It's so sad to see. My mother was a beauty queen from Louisiana. I mean, a beautiful woman. She still is at 74, whatever she is. A beauty queen, smart, charismatic, creative. They dumped her for my smart, charismatic, creative father. So, okay, meanwhile, we're all from Louisiana. My parents are from Louisiana. Her father, who had a third-grade education, a pipe fitter, said to her when she eloped with my father as an 18-year-old girl, there ain't been no damn divorces in our family, and if this don't work, you ain't coming home. And she wasn't thinking of coming home. So here she is, no aunts, no uncles, no brothers, no sisters, no parents, nobody, no friends, unemployed, uneducated, and living in the woods with four kids. And that's how our adolescence began. And that's where I went back to when I was trying to pursue the question, what was I doing instead of playing sports? 1 year, we moved three times for cheaper rent, and I was always the new kid. My mother got a job as a nurse's aide and a waitress, got a degree in social services, began working in social services. We were always broke. We were a class we don't talk about much in America. We were a member of the educated working poor. She made $112, $130 bucks a week. My father, he wasn't living high in the hog. He gave us a third or half of his income. He didn't have money either, but he lived across the river in the green walls of the liberal arts campus where he taught. And I'm just going to go from there. I'm going to read just a short section. So now it's 1973. I'm 14. This is Haverhill, Massachusetts, which is north of Boston. So long there. You're from Haverhill? Get out. Nice to meet you. So Lowell, if you didn't know before, from Jack Kerouac, the fighter, Mickey Ward, Dickie Eklund, awesome friggin' movie. By the way, can you get over that friggin' Welsh actor Christian Bale's nailing? He didn't just nail blue-collar Boston. He nailed blue-collar Merrimack Valley. All right, so we're from Merrimack Valley where they all friggin' talk like this. Hey, what's your name, honey? Nice to see ya. By the way, in my town, they say, hey, have you read the book? Have I read the book? I'm friggin' in the book. So there's a story about that later I want to tell you. So anyways, the Merrimack River runs along the Massachusetts-New Hampshire border. Lowell, Lawrence, Haverhill, Amesbury, they're all mill towns. textile towns. And Haverhill was a big producer of shoe soles, 90% of the shoe soles in America, until Italy started exporting them cheaper and better made and went belly up. When he moved there in the 70s, it was just a depressed, ugly, abandoned waterfront town. I mean, riverfront town. It had the highest, the seventh worst drug problem in the country in the high school. The river was so polluted in places, it was nearly flammable. It's a lot better now. It's come a long way. That's all you need to know. There's my older sister, Suzanne, my brother, Jeb, my younger sister, Nicole. Across the river was Bradford, and that's, I'll just read. On the other side of the river was Bradford. It's where a lot of jocks at the high school lived. The kids who wore corduroys and sweaters and looked clean. It's where houses had big green lawns. It's where the college was, where Pop taught. It's where he lived in an apartment building with Theo Matrakos and his friend Dave Supple, a writer too. Since leaving our mother, Pop had lived in a few places, but we rarely saw them and never slept there. Years later, I would hear my father say the divorce had left him dating his children. That still meant picking us up every Sunday for a matinee, and if he had the money, an early dinner somewhere. For a few years now, he was taking us to church, too. He'd pull up in his rusted-out Lancer and drive us to Mass at Sacred Hearts in Bradford Square. The five of us would walk down the aisle between the crowded pews, Jeb and I with our long hair, it was actually to our waists, Suzanne in her tight hip huggers, Nicole in her brace she now wore for scoliosis, Pop, one of the only men in church not wearing a jacket or tie. He refused to put money in the collection basket, too. Many times I'd hear him say, "You think Jesus ever wore a fucking tie? Did Jesus spend money on buildings?" One night, when we were still living at the doctor's house, real quick, so one of the places my mother rented used to be a doctor's office, and at least once every 2 weeks, someone would walk into the front door. Us four latchkey kids would be lying on this dirty rug watching 14 hours of bad TV on three channels. One guy sat down in a trench coat and a tie, sat down, picked up a newspaper off the floor. I mean, the place was a mess. No potted plants, no receptions. He read for like 20 minutes. I'm going, oh, I was the oldest son. I was too shy to say anything. At one point, he looks up and says, he looks around, you know, Gilligan's Island. This is the doctor's office, isn't it? No, he moved. Oh, he jumps up, he runs out of there. Anyway. One night, when we were still living at the doctor's house, I heard Mom on the phone trying to convince Pop that he should start taking out each of us one at a time, that he was never going to know us as individual people if he didn't. I don't know if I cared then about that or not, but a cool sweat broke out on my forehead just thinking about being alone with Pop. I'd never been alone with him. What would I say? What would we talk about? What would we do? When Mom got off the phone, she said, "I can't believe it. Your father says he'll be too shy with each of you. He's scared of his own kids." This made me feel better and worse. But every Wednesday night, he'd drive up to the house and take one of us back to his apartment across the river. It was on the third floor of an old brick building covered with ivy. Across the street was the Bradford Green, a lawn and trees and a gazebo. And you could see it from his bedroom, where his bed was always made, and there were shelves of books and his black wooden desk I remembered from when he used to live with us, its surface clean and organized, notebooks stacked neatly beside his typewriter, beside his humidor and pipe stand, six or eight of them each with a white pipe cleaner sticking out of the mouthpiece. In his small kitchen, we'd cook something, pasta and a quick tomato sauce and garlic bread we warmed in the oven, maybe a bacon and cheese omelet. This was something I looked forward to the most. It seemed I was hungry all the time. At home across the river, unless Bruce had given our mother a new check, something, Bruce was my mother's boyfriend for many years, but he had seven kids of his own in South Boston and a wife who didn't like that he was shacking up with my mother. At home across the river, unless Bruce had given our mother a new check, something he was able to do less and less now, there just wasn't much food in the house. Breakfast was usually a Coke from Pleasant Spa, bought with change we'd found in our mother's purse or under the cushions of our wicker couch. When other kids filed into the cafeteria, we didn't have the money, so drifted out back where the potheads stood on the grates, too cool to sit with the others, passing a pipe around, a bag of potato chips, too. Suzanne was selling dope. One afternoon, I stuck my head in her bedroom doorway, and she was sitting on her mattress with Glenn P., rolling dozens of joints from a garbage bag full of Mexican gold. Edgar Winter was playing on her record player. Kids at school walked up to her with a hungry look in their eyes, and my sister had cash, and after school she'd sometimes buy us subs, potato chips and Cokes and candy bars, our first real meal of the day. When Mom got home from work at close to 8 o'clock, she'd open a can of SpaghettiOs or stew for us and heat it up on the stove. Sometimes she'd fry us Spam or make that Frito pie, too tired to do much else, too broke to buy much else. And Bruce didn't cook. He'd drink bourbon in the kitchen with her and talk about the new job he had in Boston, doing the same thing she was, getting slumlords to rid their buildings of lead paint. She'd nod her head, moving quickly in her work clothes, a far-off look in her eyes, as if she was trying to put back together how her life had taken her here to this mill town, this canned food she never would have used when she was first married, these four hungry, depressed teenagers, this hovering man who wasn't their father. Those Wednesday nights at Pop's apartment waiting to eat, he probably asked me questions about my life, school, homework, friends. But what I remember is feeling like a liar and a fake. I'd be in a t-shirt and jeans I'd washed earlier so they wouldn't smell like dope. I probably told him I was getting good grades, mostly B's, which miraculously I was. But I left out that I regularly skipped half my classes, slept late, and didn't go to school several days a month. That I was flunking algebra because it was the first class of the morning when I was most high. That Jeb and I and our friend Cleary spent our afternoons looking for a house party where we could get a free buzz, or we'd be downtown in one of the shops, usually the Army and Navy store, distracting the man behind the register so Cleary could stuff a t-shirt or a pair of socks or wool cap down his pants. Sometimes we called the cops on ourselves. One of us would lower his voice and report kids throwing eggs at houses, and we'd give them the street, then run there with eggs in our pockets, and as soon as we saw the cruiser, we'd pelt it and run. One time, a cop stuck his head out the window and shouted, "I'll shoot you fucking assholes!" I remember thinking how inappropriate he was swearing at kids. And then years later, I thought, well, the shooting's kind of inappropriate too, right? We'd end up down by the river and stand on the railroad trestle over the swirling brown water below, betting who had the balls to stay on longest before the train came, and what would be worse, getting hit by the Boston and Maine, or having to jump into the Merrimack River, where you'd probably be poisoned to death before you drowned anyway. There were girls in these neighborhoods who just gave it away. One was Janice Woods, who at 15 had cropped blonde hair and breasts and hips and liked to walk up to guys and stick her fingers down their pants just so she could feel them get hard in her hand. Lately, she'd been coming around, spending afternoons with Jeb in his room. I could have told my father about her, or her father, Daryl Woods, whom our mother got to know from her work somehow. He was short and wore tight jeans and motorcycle boots, his mustache thick and blonde. One night, he and my mother went out for a drink at the VFW off Monument Square. They were sitting on stools at the bar when a muscular kid with a long ponytail walked in and asked Daryl for a light. Woods looked him over and told him to get lost. The kid pushed him, and Daryl Woods threw a short right into his face and dropped him. It was winter, and when I got up for school the next morning, the house still dark, the hallway lit up Daryl Woods sleeping on the wicker couch in the living room. He was snoring, his arm over his eyes, and I could see the dried blood and stitches in his forearm from his wrist to his elbow. After their drink, my mother and Daryl had gotten back into our car, a used red Toyota. Mom said she just started up when that same muscled kid with the ponytail ran up to her side of the car and yelled, "Duck, lady!" Then he threw a Molotov cocktail past her face at Woods in the passenger side, the bottle smashing against his raised forearm, glass and gasoline spraying over them both. But the fuse had gone out, and my mother was flooring it, downshifting and swearing. The kid in the street behind them swearing back. The inside of the car smelled like gas for weeks. One March afternoon at a day party down on 7th, Clary and I taking the joint passed to us in the loud smoking noise. A couple of rent collectors told us to beat it, and before we could stand and go, they yanked us up and pushed us down the stairs. They kicked open the door and shoved us onto the plywood porch, then off and into the mud. I remember Clary saying, "Come on, Ricky, we didn't do nothing, come on." And Ricky J., who months later would get stabbed in the same apartment he was kicking us out of, punched Cleary in the face, his head snapping back, a whimper coming out of him as Kenny V. shouldered me up against the porch, then without a word started throwing punches into my chest and ribs and arms. I covered up and he smacked me in the forehead and the temple, and I raised my hands and he went to work on my body. But he wasn't hitting as hard as Clay Whalen had, and a voice in my head said, "This is it? This is all?" I nearly clenched my fist and started punching back, but they both carried buck knives, and the one wailing on Cleary, Ricky J., was on top of him now, punching him over and over in the head. Then it was done. They were on the porch, breathing hard, looking down at us. Cleary was just getting to his feet, blood dripping from one eye in between his teeth. Ricky J. lit up a cigarette and flicked a match over our heads. "No more mooches, now screw." Before we were even to the street, Cleary started laughing. He turned and yelled, "Losers!" And we ran up the hill and across Main Street and down the alley to his house and mother. There were the Murphy brothers, four of them. They'd drive up to house parties where they didn't know anyone, walk in, drink what they wanted, smoke what they wanted, eat what they wanted, grab the butt or breasts of any girl or woman nearby, and if anybody ever said anything to them about it or even looked at them wrong, they'd jump him right there, four of them on one. Dennis was the youngest. He was tall and had dirty blonde curly hair and a cracked front tooth. It was a warm afternoon in April or May, and Jeb and Cleary and I were walking back from Round Pond, a reservoir where there were woods, and you could find kids smoking dope there in the trees or passing tall boys around in front of a fire till somebody called the cops or the fire department, and you'd run and not look back. That afternoon, Cleary taught us how to get high just by breathing deep and fast for a full minute, then have someone put you in a bear hug and squeeze till you felt your brain float up and fizz out the top of your head. I was afraid to do it. It seemed dangerous to me, bad for your heart. But I watched Jeb squeeze Cleary and dump him in the pine needles where he lay a long time, his eyes closed, his mouth open. When he came to, he was pale, but he smiled and said, "That was boss. That was so friggin' boss." We were on the sidewalk close to Monument Square. There was a sub shop there between a drugstore and convenience store. Sometimes the owners tossed out a pizza or a sub nobody ever picked up for takeout, and we'd find them in the dumpster out back, still warm and in the box or wrapped tightly in white deli paper. "Hey, faggots." It was Dennis Murphy. He ran across the street, then fell in step with us, as if we knew him, as if we were friends. "How's it hanging? Sucking any hog?" We never stopped walking, and he walked with us. He had a light pine branch in his hand, a foot and a half long, and he was slapping it against his palm as he walked. My heart was beating fast, and my mouth had gone gummy. We were getting close to the square, the gas stations and shops, cars driving around the statue of the Union soldier in the middle of the asphalt. An old woman was walking in our direction on the sidewalk ahead of us. She was short and small. Her hair was white. Even though the air was warm, she wore a thin coat buttoned to the top, and she carried two full grocery bags, one in each arm. I started to move to the side. I remember hoping Murphy wouldn't say anything about sucking hog as we passed her. Her eyes had been on the concrete, on where it was cracked and where it was heaved and buckled. But now she looked up at us, and she seemed to pull her groceries in tighter. None of us moved to the side, and she had to nearly step in the street as we passed, and that's when Murphy flicked his branch out and slapped her face, her eyes blinking and tearing up, and he kept walking. We all kept walking. Cleary laughed like he thought it was funny when I knew he didn't. I don't remember what Jeb said or did, but I did nothing. The old woman was yelling something at us. I could hear the shock in her voice, the outrage. She said something about the police and her dead husband. She yelled, "I hope you're proud of yourselves," her voice tremulous. And to walk beside Dennis Murphy for even another heartbeat felt like poison to my own blood, but I kept walking. In my visits with Pop once a month, I could have told him that story or the others, but why would I? Thank you. It actually has a happy ending for all. It actually kind of does. I just want to say one more thing. Let's have a conversation. So a few pages later, I write about a moment where my brother is a grown man comes home on leave expressly to beat up my 13-year-old brother, and he does, because my brother is having sex with his sister, but everybody was doing that. And I couldn't defend my brother. This guy was a big, scary, 190-pound guy to my 105 or whatever I weighed. And then my mother, who was home, she was always gone 14 hours a day working down in Boston. She was home with the flu, and she came out swinging a stick with 103 fever, and he called her a fucking whore, and I still didn't do anything because I was paralyzed with fear because he was a Murphy. Three of them are dead now. Two became bank robbers. He's in prison. He's in prison. You know why he's in prison this time? He's actually in county jail. He's done prison time. He's in county jail. You know why? Because two winters ago, he was asking elderly ladies if he could shovel their driveways for just a few bucks. And then he would break into the back of their house and steal their jewelry or whatever. I went into my bathroom in my house, our rented house. I was 14 years old. I looked at my 14-year-old face, and I told it, I don't care if you get killed. I don't care if you get shot, stabbed. I don't care if someone kicks your brains out. You're never, ever going to not fight ever again. And I began to do push-ups and sit-ups that night. I began to lift weights. I joined a boxing club, and much to my surprise, not only had athletic ability, but I developed a knockout punch. And the first fight I was in was about a year later. A local thug pushed my little brother down the stairs of a bar room because my brother was wearing slippers, wool hand-knitted slippers. And I knocked his eye teeth down his throat, this guy, with one punch, and it felt so good. I did it for a decade. But I hated violence, and hopefully if my book's about nothing, it's not a celebration of violence because I know what it's like to be beaten up, and I know what it's like to beat up. And I did it for years. And, you know, years later, one of my novels is called The Garden of the Last Days, and one of the characters is modeled after the 9/11 hijackers. It's from the point of view of a young Saudi Arabian from the southwestern province of Saudi Arabia. And while I was writing it, I felt this strange kinship with him, although I have nothing in common with these genocidal maniacs. Except I knew what it was like to not care if you died. Because I actually was afraid to fight no one. Don't get me wrong, I had adrenaline and all that, but I would fight anyone. Because I at bottom didn't care if I was beaten to death. Because I would rather die than look at a coward in the mirror again. And I won't tell you the whole damn book, but it was finding creative writing that got me on a path of empathy and gave me a way to express myself that was not with fists. And anyway, that's my little story, and I'm sticking to it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, what do you want to talk about? So when I stare at you, you stare at me. Thank God.
Well, I'm not the only writer in the room who's had that happen. I have to pull you in.
My friend Dave Robleski wrote The Story of Edgar Sawtelle is in the back. He's a good buddy of mine. I will tell my story if you tell yours, because I don't think I ever heard yours. You got to tell yours, because I've never heard yours. All right, so it's a good problem to have, by the way. So Brett Lott, who I think was like number 5 in her writer list, you know, Oprah did not pick new books. She picked a book. And the only the criteria was the writer had to be alive. And Brett Lott whose novel Jewel she picked early on, said, you know, expecting Oprah to pick your book for her book club, it's like expecting to walk down the street and get hit in the head with a moon rock. You know, the chances, you know, we publish 50 to 70,000 new books a year. And she would pick a book from any year. And she is a voracious reader. So, all right, so I'm working five jobs, adjunct faculty, remodeling two houses. We're having our three kids. My wife is a modern dancer who upholsters furniture and teaches dance classes. We had like 14 W-2s. I don't think we made $30,000 in a year. We might have made $30,000 one year when we were flush. And so my, you know, the book got a lot of nice critical attention, House of Sand and Fog, and then Random House published it as a vintage paperback, and their first printing was 30,000 copies. Let me tell you something. Most books you read in college will sell 3,000 to 4,000 copies when they're published. The books you read by great writers. A literary publisher will consider the book a commercial success if it sells 15,000, 20,000 copies. Open the champagne. So House and Fog was my third book, and my first two books may have sold 1,500 combined, and my mother bought 1,200 of them. And never read them. They're in her garage, all moldy. And so the book had taken off in stores like this, Pat. God bless you in independent bookshops across the land, my darling, because really, the future of democracy depends upon this. I don't get on a soapbox, but don't buy a Kindle and boycott Amazon. They are scorched earth bad people. Don't do it. And they're killing independent bookshop more than superstores did. Don't get me started on that. So anyway, the first printing for the paperback was 30,000. I said to my paperback editor, don't embarrass me, please. Print 500. Oh, don't worry about it. All right, so this is crass to give you book sales numbers, but you need to know, because Oprah herself didn't know what she did. So it's about 6 months in the paperback, and it's going into its ninth printing, and it sold over 100,000 copies. I think it can never get better than this. Are you kidding me? And my wife and I were, you know, we bought 2 acres of land, but I said, but I'll never have enough money to build a house because, you know, you get 53 cents a paperback, by the way, of that $15 paperback. So I said, well, but at least we have 2 acres of land. We can go out there and make a fire and get shit-faced around it, play the guitar, fry a few dogs. And I never went any higher than that in my dream world. But I was hoping, and we're starting to design it with my brother, and we got a hill, and the sewage system would have to be uphill, and I would have to get a pump to literally pump, you know what, uphill, and the pump alone was $5,000. I'm thinking, I'm never gonna build a house. I come home from a day of carpentry and teaching, and there's a lady on the answering machine. My boys are out back slaying Barbies with lightsabers. My daughter's up in her room. My wife's up above on her ancient sewing machine doing slip covers for $50 a pop. And I'm cooking, you know, a tomato sauce, and I'm drinking my glass of Merlot from my jug that lasts a month that costs $10. Life is good. I mean, I never had anything more than this, really. I mean, I'm living better than I did growing up. And I see this lady's on the machine. She says, hi, my name's Alice. You probably met Alice. I represent a book group here in Chicago, and we'd like to have you, blah, blah, blah. I thought it was like, you know, these ladies who have 12 people at the house, they drink a bunch of wine, you come over. And I called her, hey, Alice, hey, nice to hear from you. Are you guys reading it in your club? Oh, yes, we are. We're going to read it next month. I said, oh, good, thanks. Well, cool. So, she said something like, I'm calling from my friend. I thought she was calling from my friend. So whose friend are you? Excuse me? You're calling from one of my friends? I have two friends in Chicago. No, I'm calling from my friend. Well, who's your friend? Guess. Last time I checked, that's a big city over there. And she said, let me tell you, she's very well known. She's on the plane now. She can't call you. I didn't know it was her plane. I'm the first writer who never got called directly by Oprah until the next day. So, but I didn't know any of this. And my only other friend in Chicago was Rachel, who I knew was flying from Yugoslavia that night. It said, oh, are you my friend's Rachel's friend? No, I'm not your friend's friend. I'm my friend's friend. So, well, who's your friend's friend? Guess. I said, oh, I'm starting to get a little pissy. I'm, you know. stirring the sauce. My wife's going, the kids are slinging, you know, lightsabers. I'm sipping my wine. I said, and then I was in like the stillness. I thought, Chicago. I had the flu once, and I watched an Oprah show that one time. Harpo was in Chicago. No. I felt so silly, like, hey, we wrote a play, and De Niro's calling to be in it. So I get on the, so I say, Alice, I don't mean to be, I feel silly, but this, I don't know, this isn't, I don't know, remotely TV related at all. Yes, Oprah picked your book for her book club. I said, you gotta be fucking shitting me. Pardon me. She says, no, I'm not shitting you. But she didn't say the F word. No, I'm not shitting you. And I said, hey, Alice, I don't mean to be crass or anything, but how many people in that club of yours? Oh, we get at least 1 million. Oh, Jesus. Alice, I'll be able to buy my septic pump. So it was a working joke. And I said, first of all, how do I know? She gives me these numbers, blah, blah, blah. And I call up. No, so then she hangs up, and I call, and it's Harpo Projection. Like, oh, Jesus. And you're not, you know, as Dave's going to tell you, you can't tell anyone because she has to announce it on her show. So I couldn't tell anyone. My mother, I said, I have to tell my wife, and I have to tell my agent. That's it. No one else. And the editor. So I called the editor, and the next printing was supposed to be another 30,000 copies. Well, that ninth printing went from being another 30,000 to another 900,000. And it's just incredible influence, which Oprah really wasn't aware of, I don't think, for a while. So I'm going to end my story now. I go up to my wife, Fontaine, who's a modern dancer, who's Greek and very graceful and very beautiful. She's got her glasses on, her hair's pulled back. She's got an apron on. Hey, honey, I got a new glass of wine. Thinking about how much a Dom Perignon costs. I said, hey, honey, you know that lady from Chicago, the book club? Yeah, yeah, they're reading your book? That's nice. It's the Oprah book club. And she looks at me, and it was like this silent scream. It was like... And then she... I'd always heard the word, but I'd never seen it done. I'd always heard the word. And then she's kind of floating away from the sewing machine. And then she's kind of falling, and I'm laying her down. And then we're thinking, I think this is what they call a swoon. I've never made my wife swoon, but Oprah did. I said, honey, I know it's great to have all these readers, but we might be able to build our freaking house. That's my story. What's your story? She called your house. Yeah, okay. All right. Yes, ma'am. Oh, you went to Bradford Junior College?
I did, and I had your daughter as a professor.
Are you Meredith? Is that you? What's your name?
Oh, I just had him as a professor, and he was a legendary figure in the school at that time in the 60s.
What year were you there? What years?
67, 68.
Wow. I mean, he started there in 67. I miss him. You know, he was... Thank you so much. You know, my dad, if you haven't read him, you have to read him. He was a beautiful short story writer. His work will live for many, many, many years. He's still getting more readers. You know, one of the most difficult things, I was talking about this earlier today, I think one of I can tell you, and I know I'm not the only person in this room to have written about, I bet you've written about your lives too, and if you haven't, you're going to run into this problem or this challenge. You know, I read a quote years ago. Someone said, if you're going to write memoirs, you should be able to sue yourself for libel. I said, I really like that. And the only memoirs I'd read were Tobias Wolff's This Boy's Life, great book, right? And his follow-up one, In Pharaoh's Army. And what I so admired about This Boy's Life, despite the fact that it read like a novel, which I admired about it most, is he was a manipulative little bastard, and he did not let himself off the hook. He had a single, overwhelmed mother, too. And he would use her exhaustion to get what he wanted. And I thought, man, do I trust you to tell me everything now? Because you are not trying to make yourself look good. So I thought I could do that, but I was very surprised at how difficult it would be to write about family. And how do you do that? How do you write honestly but fairly? And it still, you know, it still bothers me. But I think I did write honestly but fairly, but I still feel, I don't know. I'm a little worried about meeting him in the afterworld, to tell you the truth. Although I don't know why I'm looking up. Good, thank you. Marjorie, how are you?
Story, that had its context in their story.
Yeah, that's great. And I'm about to get the hook, yeah? Let me in on this. Okay.
I want to do it.
I know, but I understand. So many years had passed. I mean that the scene of the elderly lady getting the branch in the face, I couldn't have even admitted that to someone 15 years ago. Even 10 years ago, I think I would have had a hard time doing that. But now I'm 52, the kid's 14. I feel fatherly towards that boy I was. I feel protective of him. I want to hug him. Say, you're a little scared boy. What do you want? But, so I was prepared to write about my stuff. I finished the draft, first draft. I left all my family out because as soon as I began to go down their road, it felt like a violation of their privacy. All those mythical taboos go off, especially about betraying mother and father. I can't do that. And my editor wisely said, you know, I don't know your family story, but it seems like there's a lot going on in that house you're not talking about. And then another friend of mine who knows the family said, you know, how can you write about your boyhood honestly and leave out the fact that your sister was gang raped and your brother was suicidal and abused sexually and your mother was depressed, on and on. And I said, well, he said, that's part of your story too. So then Richard Rousseau, the novelist whose next book, by the way, is going to be a memoir about his mom, said, I saw him in a literary thing. I said, man, I'm really tortured by this. I really don't know how much of my family to bring in. He gave the greatest advice. He said, if it were me, he said, I'd ask myself, am I trying to hurt or skewer anybody with this book? And he said, if I concluded, yes, I am, he said, I wouldn't publish it. I'd write it, but I wouldn't publish it, or I wouldn't write it. He said, but if I honestly concluded, no, I'm not trying to hurt anybody. I'm just trying to capture as honestly as I can from the subjective lens of my own memory what my life was like. He said, then I go ahead and write it. And I knew as soon as he said that, I wasn't mad at my mom. I wasn't mad at my dad. I didn't even feel sorry for the kid I was or the boyhood I'd had. They're a lot worse out there, by the way. And I just felt artistically compelled to capture it the way I feel writing a novel. And so then I did. And then my strategy was, but I'm not going to write too much about my family because that's their business. But my brother was sexually abused by a grown woman from when he was 13 to 19, his special ed teacher. She, in my house, every day, my mother knew about it. I can tell you this. If it was a 13-year-old girl and a 35-year-old man, my mother wouldn't have stood for it for 3 minutes. But it was so different when the genders were reversed. And we know now it was sexual abuse, and it's had lingering effects to this day on my brother. Walking by his bedroom on a Tuesday afternoon when I'm 14 and I hear the sounds of sex and the moaning of a grown woman, I'm going to put in the moaning. But I'm not going to go on the other side of the door because that's my brother's story. And that was my strategy. So then, Marjorie, I had to tell him I was doing this. And I cannot tell you, I wasn't going to give him veto power because I concluded, nope, this is my story too. I'm going to go to this limit. I'm not going to go on and on. It's a 400-page book, 4 pages about my brother. But it's a significant 4 pages. And I'll just say what my brother, well, I'll tell you 2 things and I'll shut up. My mother, I was spewing, I was, you know, mumbling, Ma, you know, I'm writing this Oh, honey, I know you're writing the memoir. I said, I feel like I need to be more honest about how you kind of lost control for a while. Oh, honey, she reaches over, grabs my hand. Don't you not write anything because of me. You write your story. It's not my story anyway, it's your story. You write it the best way you know how. Besides, honey, I'm so old, I don't give a shit what anyone thinks about me. And then my brother, I tell him I'm on the phone, we couldn't meet one-on-one, he's working, and I tell him, and I'm going to include the suicidal stuff and the abuse, and I say, I think it's an important color I got to paint, and I'm sorry. And he says, brother, first there was silence, I was about to throw up. He said, brother, I would never want to step on anybody's tube of paint. Isn't that great? Should I take one last?
Oh, I just had a question.
Yes, sir. Yeah, zero.
In Boston for 7 years, that's where I met Miss Lowell over here. I thought baseball was a religious Boston.
It is.
In fact, I broadcast minor league baseball
Oh, yeah. I used to box in Lynn.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how did you do as a coach?
Well, we went to the championship game, my friend. In fact, won it. Yeah. Although, full disclosure, at that point, I was demoted to assistant coach. The father saw who the hell was running the show. Mike, what's his last name? He became the real guy, but I was so good with the in the dugout with the kids. And this, years later, he said, I still get a kick out of that speech you gave those guys in the dugout. It was a championship game. They're playing. They're ignoring the game. And I gave him a speech about, you know, when you're an actor on stage, do you know that actually your energy, you're fed off the attention of your audience? It was a complete arts theater speech. But it galvanized the kids. Yes, ma'am. Oh, hell yeah. Oh, there's so many. My God. I have to say, I read so much poetry. I just bought Billy Collins' edited new 180 poems for 180 days. But I'm reading a really wonderful first novel by a guy named Ben Lerner, who actually has published three collections of poems first, called Leaving, how do you pronounce A-T-O-C-H-A in Spanish?
Atochi?
Is it Atochi? I think it's Leaving Atochi Station by Ben Lerner. It's something else. And before that, I read The Art of Fielding, which I think is gorgeous. I've been reading a lot of first novels lately. I read one that I cannot forget is Open City by a guy named Teju Cole, Nigerian writer. So many great ones. You all, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.